So welcome to the Fatigue Super Conference. And for this conversation, I'm talking with Jason Prohl, who has got a fascinating insight into health and wellness. To give his background, Jason is a former mechanical engineer, turned entrepreneur, filmmaker, health educator, and practitioner. Over the last 10 years, Jason transitioned from working in the iterative disease care model to a model of health optimization and lifestyle medicine. In May of 2018, his independent research experience as a practitioner was used as the basis for the creation of a 9-part documentary film series called The Human Longevity Project, which uncovers the complex mechanisms of chronic disease and aging and the true nature of longevity in our modern world. He's currently working on his next film series that explores the ancient methods of healing mind, body, and spirit from indigenous cultures around the world. This is going to be a fascinating one because I think sometimes we can get very caught in focusing on fatigue, how we fix that, how we work with that, how we understand that. What really draws me to Jason and his work is that, in a sense, he's been looking at this from the other kind of flip side of going out there and studying people which have optimized kind of fantastic health, well-being, and not because they're spending their life focusing on trying to be optimized in their kind of wellness, but that's the way that they're living. So that's somewhat we're going to come into. Jason, thank you so much for making the time. Great to have you.
Yeah, thanks for being here.
I'd love to start just by getting a bit more of a sense of you. As I was reading out in your biography, you've had a bit of a journey in terms of your own kind of interest and kind of seeking in this area. What inspired you to become fascinated by human longevity?
Well, it really started with my own health issues and the things that I was dealing with in my journey, you know, in my 20s and 30s, and really not finding answers from the traditional medical community. And, you know, back then, you know, 15, 20 years ago, the internet was really not a huge help in this sense. And so it was sort of trial and error, but eventually I kind of found my way. And then as the internet became more of a resource and a tool, you know, it really propelled me to discover more and more about the origins of some of these chronic diseases that we particularly face in the West. And then I went into the integrative practitioner kind of healthcare model, you know, using things like functional medicine, integrative medicine, and some of the testing and the tools and the theories and the practices. And that was a really beneficial training for me. And I was able to help, you know, a number of people with a lot of things. I did find that it fell short in terms of reaching and resolving some of these really chronic conditions that I ended up working with, you know, multiple autoimmune conditions, cancers, some of these really difficult things. And really what I found was missing was the health component. You know, as you mentioned, you know, we get stuck in this disease care model and trying to figure out disease, resolve disease, understand disease. And in that process, which I do think is an important part of the process, but we forget about trying to understand health. So what is it that makes us healthy? Where does health come from? You know, those are important questions. And that's really where I started to veer off. And this, you know, allowed me to look at things from a new perspective. So I think this is really the focus of my work and really what I enjoy doing is trying to teach people and remind people, really, because we all know the things that make us healthy. It's really about remembering some of these things, getting back in touch with them, and removing the stigmas around some of the aspects of lifestyle that facilitate health as opposed to, you know, contributing and leading us towards a path of disease.
When you were filming the Human Longevity Project, I think you visited something like 50 locations in 9 countries. That's kind of a mission of filmmaking and research. I guess I'm curious as to what were some of the key things of those people which, you know, were living long, but not just long lives, like healthy long lives. One of the things that I think we can all be terrified about is the idea of living to an old age with kind of increasing disability and kind of misery in that process.
Absolutely.
But the people that you discovered, what were some of those key lessons and insights that you took from that?
I mean, there's a lot there, but I think at the end of the day, they live in harmony with nature, more so than we do. They live a simpler life. They live a slower life. They live a life of balance, of community, of connection, of meaning, You know, and at the end of the day, if you look at, you know, archetypally, humans are just story and meaning. That's really all we are, and it's what we create, you know? And if you just think about that for a little while, I think you'll see what I mean. Their stories and meaning tended to be more in harmony and in balance. And so their life was more in balance, and the way that they lived was more in balance, the way that they thought and felt, and everything they did had more of a balance and a rhythm to it that was more in touch with nature. And this is what you find in indigenous cultures. This is what you find in much of the rest of the world that is still in touch with that. For us in the West, we've removed ourselves from that way of living. And we've created a lot of really cool things. We've helped a lot of people. We've raised people out of poverty. We have saved many, many lives. We have new standards of living. We have more time and ability to create. So there's a lot of good things about the Western way of life. But when it comes to disease, you know, it does contribute to more of the chronic disease than I think what we see in some of these indigenous cultures. So it's really just a shift that we've seen over the course of history. We're not dying at birth as much. We aren't dying of deadly, you know, infectious diseases as much. We're not dying of traumatic injuries as much. But we are now dying and suffering in a chronic way more than we ever have before. And now I think what we've seen is that we've reached the peak of this in our civilization. We have now seen lifespan start to kind of peak, and health span has, in my opinion, has peaked a little while ago. And we're now seeing people on drugs and medications and needing assistance at the age of 30 and 40 and 50 like never before. So we're just now starting to see a shift in things. And I think if we want to resolve those chronic issues and bring back a healthier way of living, less suffering, more happiness, more meaning, more purpose, more gratitude, all those things, then we've just got to shift our thinking and adopt some of those principles that we see in these indigenous cultures and cultures like that we saw in our human longevity film in Okinawa, in Sardinia, Italy, in Icaria, Greece, in Costa Rica. We need to adopt some of those, bring those with us, and combine those with some of the big, cool things that we've done in the West.
I really like the way you're talking about it, in a sense that there is much which is great about the privileges we have of Western life. But as you say, there's a kind of a sense of increasing disconnection from nature. But I think that's also mirrored by a disconnection from ourselves, right? That we kind of
100%
get so used to kind of being defined by what we do, by what we achieve, by being in kind of constant action, that I think often it can be hard to know who we are that's not that. And I think one of the things that often happens with fatigue, particularly on the more severe end of that spectrum, is people are kind of forced to really ask these questions. And in a sense, when you can no longer be that character where you just define yourself by your accomplishments, because you can't achieve anymore, just getting through the day or getting out of bed's its own battle. It forces people, I think, to really look at these pieces. And I know that before we started recording, you were talking about some of the differences between the kind of the what kind of I guess kind of ancient traditions would call the yin and the yang energy. I'd love to open that up a little bit and get more thoughts on that.
You hit such an important part of the discussion. To me, it's actually the entirety of the discussion, and we just break it down into parts from there. You know, I'll first state that we don't tend to see chronic fatigue in these sort of blue zone or longevity cultures. We don't see it in indigenous cultures to nearly the degree, if at all. In fact, sometimes I'd ask the people in Costa Rica or in Italy and in Sardinia, and I would ask them, you know, about cancers and autoimmune diseases and fatigues and sleep problems and digestive problems. They look at me like I'm crazy. They don't have a reference point for some of this stuff. So it's very fascinating when you ask these people, which doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It just means that it's not enough to really be a part of their awareness. But this, you mentioned it many, many times actually in sort of that lead up question. We are doing too much. We are in the West, a population, a culture of doing, and we forget to be. And so really what I see is the primary fundamental archetypal problem with chronic fatigue and many other chronic diseases is that it's too much masculine energy. It's too much yang energy. It's too much of the doer. It's not enough of the feminine, of the being, of the relaxing, of the creating. And so this is, to me, what's underlying the entire aspect of these diseases, and particularly with something like chronic fatigue. We need both, you know, and this isn't a male-female thing. This is not that at all. This is an archetypal energy. So the yang energy is the thing that, it's constantly doing. It is fire. It is masculine. It's going out there constantly doing. You know, in terms of the body, we can think of this as the mind, right? And the being or the yin is more the heart, right? Or the gut, even, where we just kind of we operate from a sense of knowing, a sense of feeling. So we're too much in our mind. We're too much doing. We don't rest. We don't listen to our intuition. The other aspect is when you look at the nervous system, right? The masculine, the yang, the doer is the sympathetic nervous system, right? This is the fight or flight. This is the thing that saves you. Thank God we have the sympathetic nervous system. And then the yin or the feminine would be the parasympathetic, right? The rest, the digest, the creation, the being, the relaxing. This is really, really important. This is where we have sex, right? If you think about creation and the feminine, that's the place we have sex from. This is the place we digest food from. This is the place we recover and repair from. So we don't have a balance in those two states. We are too much in the yang, in the masculine, in the doer, in the sympathetic. We need to balance this out. And not only do we need to balance it out, we need the polar extremes. So we need to be fully on and fully off as much as we can. The state of middle ground is not a good place to be. It may seem counterintuitive, but we need more stress. We just need the right kinds of stress, right? We need more hormetic stress, right? The heat and the cold, the sunlight. We need exercise and movement, you know, but we also need to compensate that with the shutting off, shutting down. And so we need both of those things, you know, the dark. And that is an important aspect of where we need to be. We're too much in this middle ground. Imagine just to give you context. Imagine that, I don't remember if you remember the Seinfeld episode. For those that do, it's a great episode. For those that don't, I'm sorry, I apologize for this example. But Kramer actually has this theory that he was going to sleep like 15 minutes every hour or every 2 hours or something like this.
Right.
And it's a hilarious episode. And imagine that, where you never really fully sleep for a long period of time, but you're never really fully awake. You're constantly in this zombie state. Well, that's, I think, what we're finding ourselves in, is that we're not really stressing ourselves enough and we're not really relaxed enough. And if you look at the cultures that we visited in the Human Longevity Project, these people were moving like crazy. They would walk like 30 or 40 kilometers a day sometimes. They would work their tail off on the farm, herding sheep or whatever it was. They were constantly working, and then they were shutting off, sleeping really well, shutting down. You know, and usually you would have a siesta in the middle of the day where they're completely shut down, or they would have the Sunday, you know, where they don't do anything. Yes. Except for be with family. So we're not doing enough of the extremes. We're too much in the middle ground. We're constantly going, and we're not going hard enough, and we're not stopping. So big things.
Yeah, and it seems to be particularly in I think cities like London and kind of where there's that real kind of doing, kind of pushing, kind of attitude, that even the things that we do to switch off end up getting hijacked. Like I remember getting on for 20 years ago, going to yoga classes in London, and it'd be kind of a form of exercise to go and slow everything down and kind of restore. And then I went for a number of years, and kind of 10 years went past and I didn't go because I was doing gym or I was swimming or doing other kind of forms of exercise. And then one day I was like, I really fancy doing some yoga. So I went back to this yoga center that I'd gone to for a number of years before, and just the whole thing had changed. And it was like going from, like, the class was like doing an aerobics class. And I was just like, what is this? It was like,
we have hot yoga. Right. Yes, we have hot yoga. We've got, like, we're bringing weights into yoga now. And what I've noticed is actually kind of cool is, I think in response to that, we're actually seeing something, at least in Southern California, pop up quite a bit, which is yin yoga.
Yeah,
so they're actually having to define yoga, redefine yoga, because we've just pushed it to the extreme in the masculine and yang, in the doer mentality too much. So totally. I love that you hit that, because it's totally odd and kind of ironic that we did that.
Yeah, yeah. This point you're making around having these kind of these polars and these extremes, it's fascinating, and it kind of makes intuitive sense. It's something that I kind of see in my own life, that if I have a day where I just kind of, I work from home, I kind of get up, I'm at my desk and I'm kind of busy, but I'm kind of not moving my body, it's really hard to switch off properly in the evening and sleep well at night. If I go and take some kind of proper exercise, or I kind of change up and move, it's like, it's much, you're more physically tired. And I think often what can happen is that we mentally, you're kind of using a kind of a lot of the kind of yang energy, but actually we don't use the physical, and so it doesn't switch off. Is that how you would see it in terms of needing to move energy to then be able to have the deeper rest?
Absolutely. And I think we can see this across many systems, right? One of the 98-year-old gentlemen in Greece, I believe, he said, when I was young, the body was busy and the mind was still. Now what I see is the problem is the mind is busy and the body is still. Huh. So I thought, wow, right? I mean, just brilliance from a 98-year-old dude. And he's totally correct. So right now, you know, entrepreneurial people like you and I mean, I don't know about you. I struggle with shutting off my mind when it comes to the business. Like, I can't stop thinking about what needs to get done tomorrow and all these things. So that is my problem. I've got to fix that. So I've got to find ways, tools, methods to shut that off, whether that's meditation, whether that's a walking meditation, whether it's a sauna, whether it's having sex. I don't care, anything to shut off my mind from that overdrive. So we've got to find those tools. That didn't used to be a problem because a lot of the people, that they were living in rhythm with nature. So you couldn't hurry the growth process of the squash. It's like the season dictates that, the weather dictates that. You couldn't worry about the weather, you couldn't worry about the climate, you couldn't worry about the way that the soils are operating. You just had to take action in the moment and move with what nature was providing. So we've now created situations where we're not shutting off. So we have to shut off the mind because the mind is constantly going. But then also, as you mentioned, we've got to move our bodies. We've got to move them more often. And our bodies really are designed to do that. And so I think when we look at working out, sometimes we're overdoing it with working out because our mind, again, if we're constantly in the mind space, constantly doing, then sometimes actually working out can be too much, right? When we think about hormetic stress, the idea, I'm sure you've had people talk about this, the idea with hormetic stress is that there's this certain Goldilocks point where if we don't do enough, we're not optimized. If we do too much, we're not optimized. So there's this nice hump somewhere in the middle where the right amount is optimal for us, and it's different for everybody. So if we are overstressing ourselves in some fashion, then exercise can be too much. So walking is a fantastic way of exercising, moving the body to where it's not too extreme. And then, you know, if we have the capacity, then we can move our bodies a little bit more physically and push ourselves. And the idea there with these extremes is to build up resiliency, right? You know this, you and I, both white guys. If I get too much sun, immediately I burn. It's not good, right? But if I build up a tan with the seasons, right? If my skin slowly adapts and becomes more resilient to the sun, then as we get into peak season, my skin can tolerate more sun, but it can't right as I'm coming out of winter. So this is a great example. The same thing with the exercise or lifting weights, maybe. You know, if I go in and try to bench press 400 pounds, ain't gonna work. It's not gonna be pretty, I'm gonna hurt myself. But if I get stronger over time and I build up the resilience so that my frame can execute on that, then all of a sudden pushing that 400 pounds can be beneficial. So, but it's different for all of us. So we've got to find our sweet spots, and we've got to keep pushing ourselves so that we can be more resilient, but not push ourselves past the limit to where we're causing damage.
Yes. And I think one of the real challenges that can happen when fatigue starts to get more severe is people's capacity to exercise and move their body gets increasingly depleted. And then people can end up in the state of being tired but wired, like they're depleted and there's not the energy and the capacity to exercise. But then there's this kind of on edge with the nervous system, which then makes it very difficult to switch off. And I think it's almost an extreme version of that kind of middle ground, in a sense, that you were talking about, where you don't have the on and therefore you don't have the off. Any thoughts of how people can start to kind of rebalance and start to kind of shift that?
Yeah. So, you know, when the system is to that point where you don't have much energy and but you're also really tired and you can't work out and you can't seem to get anywhere, there's somewhere, something in your system that's depleting you. Could be a virus, could be your mental and emotional states, could be traumas that have dictated the constant on of the nervous system, if you will. It could be a lot of different things. You've got to figure out what is running your system hot. And it could be historically. So this actually could be something in the past that you have not been able to recover from. So for some people, you can switch all that off, get results in terms of shutting everything down. but you haven't been able to build up the recovery process. So that needs to happen. And it's just like if your house burns down, you can't just go move into your house just because you put out the fire. You got to rebuild, yeah. Right? So, yeah. So there is a process of rebuilding that we have to respect. And this oftentimes, especially with chronic fatigue, has to do with mitochondria, you know, mitochondrial biogenesis, creating new mitochondria, mitochondria that doesn't have damaged DNA, mitochondria that's not producing, you know, reactive oxygen species or free radicals at exorbitant rates, and causing further damage and DNA damage and poor gene regulation and all these things that happen when you have poor functioning mitochondria. So rebuilding our mitochondria, getting rid of the old bad functioning mitochondria through autophagy and some of these other cellular mechanisms, that takes time. So we have to figure out first where the problems are in our system and try to get some resolution around that. So, you know, shutting down those things that are running our system hot. The other aspect is, I think, really getting more rest. If we look at chronic fatigue, what are we talking about? We're talking about a system that has basically run itself into the ground. You know, it doesn't have the capacity. So the body, sometimes it's because the system is not able to function. And oftentimes that is, but a lot of times too, what we see is downregulation of things like thyroid hormone and some of these other systems that are trying to slow us down on a system level. It's like, hey, too much, slow the hell down. We're gonna downregulate some of this stuff. We're gonna produce more reverse T3, whatever it is, to give you a sense of like, hey, dude, you know, the body's speaking to you. So if it's telling you to slow down, probably a good idea to slow down somewhere. You just got to figure out what in your life you got to slow down. And this is where I think sleep, you know, and when it comes to exercise, walking is the only exercise that's been demonstrated to actually have beneficial effects on longevity over the course of a human life.
Is that right?
Life.
That's really
interesting. It's the only one. Yeah. It doesn't mean that you can't do other things and that they're not beneficial, but it is the only
people
one.
People in those cultures are not going to gyms, right? So there's no research on that, I guess.
Right. Well, and why would you really ever need to physically exert yourself over the course of an entire lifetime? Yeah. Like there's periods when our 20s and 30s maybe that we really, really thrive on that type of activity, but really we're walking machines. So anyway, I think that's really what we've got to figure out is where is the system running hot, get some resolution around that, and then also find out how we can rebuild, regenerate, and repair the system. And almost always that is through slowing things down, reducing stimulus, simplifying things, getting better rest and getting better sleep. Those are the methods by which our system rebuilds and regenerates.
Yes. And I'd love to also explore a bit around, we've been talking around the kind of the yin and the yang energies, which are kind of obviously both exist within all of us, but we have different kind of ways that we're balancing those. But also how about the kind of nature's rhythms and our kind of how our circadian rhythm is kind of in tune with that. I'd love to hear more of your thoughts around that.
Yeah, circadian rhythm is huge. This is an area of study that now science is really, really digging into in profound ways. In fact, the Nobel Prize was given to a man that centered his study around this topic. And the idea of circadian rhythm is really just this rhythm of the sun, right? The light cycle. And of course, this light cycle changes depending on where you're on the globe. You know, if you're in the north or you know, in the south, you know, in the southern regions of South Africa or Australia, going to be different than, you know, equatorial regions, right? The equatorial regions tend to have more of a 12 hours on, 12 hours off. But in the polar extremes, we have, you know, seasonal aspects that really, really change. But it's really us and our biology synchronizing with the rhythms of the sun, of the light and dark cycle. And it's funny because our whole biology is dictated on this cycle. So, you know, if we're not synchronized with our natural light cycle in our given region, then we're a mess. And we all know this. Anybody who's ever traveled across time zones knows this. This is what we call jet lag, right? The idea of jet lag is simply the fact that our biology is on, let's say, you know, Los Angeles time. And when I fly to London, now all of a sudden the light cycle's on London time. My biology is like, whoa, 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 hold on. Like this ain't right. Like what's happening here? Right. And it takes days or weeks to reset that. And that's if I'm doing the right things. So we all inherently experience this idea. But the problem that we see now with technology in particular driving this massive problem is that we're watching, you know, TV at 11 p.m. or midnight. We are on computers and cell phones. And this artificial light is not only is it not sunlight, it is not synchronized with the light cycle, and it's driving our biology crazy. And every cell, every organ is guided by this light cycle. You know, and so what we see is the light is primarily the driver of this circadian rhythm, right? So light enters the eyes, a signal is sent through the hypothalamus and the pituitary glands of the brain. And, you know, that's sort of the major cascade that we tend to see. It also occurs on the skin as well. That's another receptor that we see for light. But what we find is that all our hormones, all our cellular functions, in fact, we have clock genes and period genes. And they're called clock genes and period genes because they are responsive to this circadian rhythm, this light cycle. And those dictate function of our organ systems, of our cellular systems. You know, just looking at an organ system, for example, the thyroid has over 1,000 genes that get regulated by the light. So they might turn on or turn off depending on the time of day. At 9 a.m., 500 and some odd genes related to the thyroid may turn on and 400 turn off. Right, and then at 5 p.m. we see, you know, this thing shift and switch. So, you know, if we're looking at light cycles and rhythms and daily rhythms and seasonal rhythms, then we have to recognize that we have to get back in touch with that light cycle. And it has to do with the feeding cycle as well, when we eat food, when we exercise. All this is dictated, all this dictates how our biology functions at the fundamental level every single day, every second, every part of the season throughout our lives. So it's really, really important.
Yeah. And I guess the further away we get from those rhythms, in a sense, it has its own stress on the system, right? That if our system is kind of, its instinct is towards kind of rest, digest, calm down, switch off, and we're pulling in the opposite direction, we're causing stress by doing that.
Absolutely. And so when you see somebody, and this is classic, you know, people for a long time, and we're starting to get out of the paradigm, but we talked about adrenal fatigue, and, you know, we had Hans Selye in the five stages and all these things about adrenal fatigue. And it's more complex than I think originally thought. And what we're seeing, you know, is people run cortisol tests, you know, the rhythm of cortisol, and you find that they're not producing cortisol at, you know, 6 and 7 and 8 a.m. like you're supposed to. You're supposed to see this. Let's see if I'm doing this the right way. You're supposed to see a huge spike in cortisol and then in the morning, and then it slowly reduces at night. And the idea there is that our bodies are meant to turn on in the morning and during the day, and then it's supposed to go to sleep. But what we see inverted cortisol rhythms, inverted melatonin rhythms, flat lines. We're just not seeing the rhythm. And I've done this so many times with clients that if I get them on the circadian rhythm, all of a sudden these cycles come back. And so if we're looking at chronic fatigue, circadian rhythm is so fundamental to resolving chronic fatigue issues that you can't not look at it. Because at the end of the day, that's really what we're talking about in circadian rhythm. We're talking about, just think about the day and the night. That is the yin and the yang, right? The yang energy is during the day. This is the sun. This is the light. This is where we do everything. The yin is at night, where we repair, we rest, we have darkness. And if we're not getting those polarizations, then we have problems. And so we need our biology to reflect that. We need a really strong cortisol, adrenaline, noradrenaline response in the morning and midday. And then we want that to shut down and essentially be non-existent at night. We want melatonin to surge at night. Melatonin is a fundamental hormone that operates, it's not only a sleep hormone. This actually is one of the most powerful antioxidants in the system. It turns on a whole host of processes at the cellular level. It is so critical to mitochondrial function, repair, regeneration, that we have to have lots of melatonin. But the idea here is not to just douse ourselves with artificial melatonin supplements, but rather produce it internally. It is absolutely critical that we produce a lot of melatonin at the right times so that our systems can shut down, repair, regenerate. And so, you know, just a cellular level, on a system level, on an operational level, and on an experiential level, these rhythms are fundamental to our health.
One of the challenges that can happen in the more severe chronic fatigue cases is, and particularly with younger people that don't have kind of families where their kind of day gets punctuated by certain things, is you notice that their sleep kind of passing gets more and more skewed. So there are people where, despite the fact they're suffering from severe fatigue, they're not sleeping till 3, 4, 5, 6 a.m. And then they're sleeping for kind of 8, 10 hours from that point. And there are some where I've seen literally they end up having to kind of go through they get to the point they're sleeping at 7-8 in the morning, and they end up having to almost just flip it to kind of try and start again. And it just seems that they just lose any sense of the kind of being in rhythm with nature. And it has its own kind of stress and its own also just social isolation, the increased socialization that goes with that. I'm wondering what some of the ways are, you know, as you're kind of outlining how important that this piece is, what are some of the practical ways that people can start to rebalance and get closer to a kind of more natural rhythm with this?
Yeah, that's a good question. And just to kind of piggyback on what you mentioned there, we see this a lot with shift workers or swing workers or nurses or anybody that's working at night and flight attendants and all these things. They have a huge increase in chronic fatigue and many other diseases. So it's not to say that this is the sole cause of chronic fatigue, but it is a major contributor to and it helps persist chronic disease to where you can't recover from it without getting this dialed in. And so part of it is that we have to get back in touch with the very simple aspects. You know, they took people that couldn't sleep. These people had legit insomnia, diagnosed full-on insomnia, took them out camping for, I think, 2 weeks or something like that. And at the end of 2 weeks, they were all sleeping. So it's not rocket surgery, right? You just got to get back in touch with nature. So what do we do in the West when we have jobs and kids and schools and all these things? First thing is, when we get up in the morning, we've got to go outside. Go outside. 30 minutes, ideally, at least in the morning. Get the light in your eyes. It doesn't have to be sunny. I live in San Diego, so the sun's always here. But I used to live in Seattle. It was nothing but clouds, right? Same thing as like London.
And we haven't seen it for 6 months here.
I feel you. I really do feel you. But at the end of the day, it's light, right? When you go outside, it's not like it's pitch black, you know, midnight. So in the morning, even though the clouds and the rain and the whatever might be there, there is still daylight. So your eyes are very, very sensitive to the natural light. And really at the end of the day, the sun is so powerful. So even through clouds, it's very, very bright. So we need to just get outside and get our eyes tuned to that light. That will set our clock. Our biology recognizes that, oh, it's morning. Turn on these genes, turn on those hormones, turn this off, turn this. So it's doing all of this. So it is critical that we get that. How many of us actually get outside in the morning? Very few. But if you have chronic fatigue, if you've got any chronic disease, it is fundamental that you do this. You make this a part of your practice. As soon as you wake up, grab your coffee, grab your tea, whatever you're doing. Probably not coffee if you have chronic fatigue. I'd highly recommend against that. But whatever your thing is, grab that, your newspaper, your dog, whatever. Go outside and get that sun. You can. The best thing to do is walk for 30 minutes. That is the best thing you could ever do, is get up in the morning and go for a walk. The second best thing would just be outside and relax. You know, whether it's yoga, a meditation, sit there and read the paper, whatever. Go outside. Critical, critical, critical. That will actually help your sleep at night by you getting that light in the morning. First thing. Ideally, we get lots of light throughout the day. So windows are great. Opening windows are even better. Getting outside is the best. But getting that natural light and shutting off of the artificial lights and not relying on those so much as a light source for us. So skylights are beautiful. Whatever you can do to get natural light during the day. And then at night, as the sun sets, and again, this is going to be different for everybody depending on where you are on the planet. But as the sun sets, we start shutting off these artificial lights that we have all around us inside. So this is overhead lights. This is lamps. This is computer screens. This is cell phones. This is TVs. Some of these things we've got to work with past sundown, right? Computers in particular become fundamental to a lot of our work. So we can use, you know, blue blocking glasses, orange glasses, red glasses. We can use filters on our computer, you know, Flux and some of these other things, Iris. They can shut down the blue spectrum of light, because the blue spectrum of light is the most critical when it comes to waking us up. So if you want to wake somebody up, use a lot of blue light. You know, if you want to put somebody to sleep, this is where the red light, you know, is more effective. You know, you can actually see this right, where is it? Right there. That's a red light device, infrared and red light device. So I'm using that to offset some of the excess blue light that I get. There is a balance with everything, right? And the sun has perfected this balance for life. So at night, we want to skew more towards the red or no light, right? And that's really what we want to do. So those are the key factors. And then the other things are abiding by the rhythm of the day. At night, we should not be working out. We should not be exercising at 10 p.m. in a gym with artificial light pushing our systems. This is the time where our system's starting to relax and get to sleep. So, you know, it can be beneficial to do like a 4 p.m. workout or something, but the middle of the day is really where we want so much of our activity. At the beginning, we want to ramp into our activity. and then we want to ramp out of it. So it's just following the rhythms. I mean, it's so simple if we just listen. But again, you mentioned at the very beginning of this conversation that we're just not listening to ourselves enough. We're not getting in touch with ourselves. We've lost that connection to ourselves. So getting that connection back is so critical, and just listening to our bodies in this regard.
It strikes me that there's a kind of a correlation or a kind of link between being in kind of tune with nature's kind of rhythm and being in tune with our own rhythm, that in a sense that the two are kind of related, right? And in a sense, the more we're in nature, the more that's going to support being in touch with our own emotions, our own bodies. But equally, the more we're in touch with our emotions and our bodies, the more we're going to be able to feel the contact and the support that nature gives us.
100%. And we think that we're separate. We think that we've even created a separation. We haven't created a separation. We can't be separated from nature. We are nature. There's no arguing this point. We are just out of balance, out of rhythm, out of tune with nature. We are it. So there's no, we're just not playing by the rules. And so if you don't play by the rules, then two things happen. Over time, life will actually adapt and modify. This is just what we see. But in the meantime, you can have disease, sickness, death, et cetera, and suffering. And so, but you're 100% right. The more we get out into nature and operate by her rules and play her game, we just start to see so many beautiful things happen. You know, I've seen people with chronic diseases, eyesight problems, you name it, weight issues, fatigue issues, and as soon as they just get in touch with nature more and play by those rules and those laws, all of a sudden the diseases start going away. You know, we have more room for creative thought. We have more room for rest and relaxation. This has been scientifically demonstrated. We see our nervous system shift. We see brainwaves shift. It all shifts once we get out into nature, in a more real and direct sense. We get in touch with our feelings more. We get out of our mind state more. So it's really about bringing this balance, I think. And that's critical. And it doesn't mean that we can't do things like this, where we're having video conferences and chats and summits. And these are beautiful things. And in fact, a lot of these conferences, the reason I really, really love them is because it gets rid of some of the ignorance. But we have to also remember that as beautiful as these summits are, don't just sit here and consume them. Don't just operate these things in your mind. You've got to put this in action and start to embody these things. Be the change. And when you do that, because this isn't ignorance, this is getting rid of ignorance, but we have to put it into action. And so I think, and sometimes the action is actually non-action.
Yes.
It's a state of being. Yes. It's stopping. So that's really, really important.
One of the things that we often say is that people which are achievers and driven, it actually takes a lot more discipline to stop than it does just to keep on going, even when one feels terrible and feels crap, right?
This is the big life lesson for me. In fact, if you look at Ayurveda and Chinese medicine, I'm actually like triple fire. I'm just like, go, go, go. My body, my system, my whole biology is all fire, fire energy, which means I actually have excess inflammation if I don't slow down. So this is, and because of the traumas that I experienced in my development and my childhood, I actually learned to do and to perform and to execute and to succeed as a way to get love, to get all my needs met. And so as I understood my own traumas as I understood my own patterns and my personality that developed from those traumas and my natural state of fire, all of a sudden it starts to make sense. And my big balancing act is to slow the heck down, to quiet things down, to slow down. And this means shutting things off, less notifications on my phone, deleting things, getting on social media less, getting out into nature more, resting more, doing more yin yoga, walking more, even though my natural tendency is to work my tail off, you know, go to the gym, do interval training. Like, I love pushing myself. I really, really do. That is my natural state. That is my sort of fire energy coming out. But if I do that too much, I'm going to burn myself to the ground in every sense of the word. And so there becomes this balancing act. And as I become more in touch with myself, and as I get to know myself more and listen to myself more, I start to hear these things coming through. Slow down, relax, you know, take a nap, go for a walk, get out in nature, go into the ocean, ground yourself. It's all these sort of yin, feminine, slow the hell down type of things. And this is the dominant aspect of most of the Western culture. It's just, I happen to exacerbate it because of my traumas and my natural system energy.
Yes. One of the challenges that we had in the early years of Optimum Health Clinic was that part of my recovery from chronic fatigue had been this very kind of yang attitude of I will figure this out, I will conquer this, and they're reading tons of books. And even when I was doing things to calm my system, I was doing things to calm my system. And one of the things that, you know, as we were talking about the kind of the circadian rhythms and kind of being in rhythm, it struck me that for those which are more comfortable in doing, it's going to be easier to, as you were saying, kind of like consume information or, you know, cut things out of their diet or take supplements than it is going to be to go and sit outside and have sunlight first thing in the morning, or to go for a gentle walk where they're much more likely to want to go and push themselves and then spend 3 days recovering from the process. And it's really interesting what you, because I was going to ask you around what you've kind of learned from these cultures that you studied in the role of kind of trauma and emotion. You were just touching on it from your own kind of experience of in those places and some of these fascinating people you've spoken to. Is it that they, I mean, I guess in some ways they probably are exposed to less traumatic things, but there are still natural disasters and there are still bereavements and crisis. And what do you see supports them in either not being traumatized in the first place or digesting and processing difficult life events more effectively?
Yeah, I think there's three main components that we need to focus on when it comes to our own disease, our own issues. One is the ignorance. So when you don't know something, you don't know something, that's a problem, right? When you don't know that you're doing something bad, that's a problem. The other one is the environment. The environment that you're in actually dictates so much of your health. And the other aspect, I think, is mind. And this is where trauma comes into play. Personalities, our safety mechanisms, these patterns that we develop because of trauma that keep us safe. And God, they're so thankful. So I'm so thankful that we have these, right? I'm so grateful for my patterns because they saved me, right? My whole life. And what's cool is that once you resolve the trauma and you get an understanding around the trauma, they become your greatest gifts, right? For somebody like you, the doer, you know, when you're in trauma, when you're in pattern, can be a problem because it's leading the way and it's can be driving the process. But when it's in balance, when you have it in your back pocket, you can pull out the doer and you got to get something done. Oh my God, what a gift, right? So it's really, really beautiful. But when we see these cultures that we visited, they certainly don't have as much trauma. One, and the reason is because they have more connection. They have more family connection. So at the root of childhood, which is where almost all trauma is really happening, is between 0 and 5 or 7 or so. And that's where so many things happen. But they have so much better of a connection, and the family units are stronger and the community is stronger, that they have less trauma in that developmental sense. But you're absolutely right. They do see, they do have traumas in their life. And because they have better connections, better attachment systems, better community support, they have a better way to deal with it and understand it. So it's really about learning what the traumas are, how they're affecting you in terms of your personality and your patterns, and then working to sort of undo that or balance that. So, you know, they don't deal much with that type of stuff. But because they have stronger connections and attachment systems, their system is able to naturally sort of calm down and not get into pattern as much. So trauma, in my mind, is probably the most fundamental and critical aspect in the West that we have to focus on when it comes to all disease, because it dictates the constant state of our nervous system, the constant state of the messages that we're sending to our biology, right? And we get into sort of Bruce Lipton's work and the biology of belief. And we talk about the belief systems and the stories and the meanings that we attach to things, right? My dad left, therefore blah, right? This is a story that I'm running in the background, in the subconscious, constantly until I understand it and get that resolved and get that balanced. So until we get to those belief systems, those stories and those meanings that are caused by traumas and you know, things that are indoctrinated in us, then we're going to have these programs running in the background that are going to be disrupting our biology in a way that's actually brilliantly designed, but it's out of balance. So we have to get that back into balance. So it's not that it's a mistake. It's not that it's a faulty program. The program is actually running perfectly. The program is just designed to save you and constantly be in this masculine, yang, sympathetic overdrive. And this is the adrenaline, this is the cortisol. So all the things that we're talking about, you know, this is not a biology problem. This is a belief system problem, a subconscious problem. So the traumas really cause the underlying foundational energies to manifest. And then that manifests in biological function. So we can't look at biological function and say, that's the problem. No, that's the response to the problem. Yes. The problem is the belief system, the subconscious, the mind space. That's what we've got to fix when it comes to trauma. Because you can't undo the trauma. Trauma has been done, right? So we have to fix the belief systems in the mind around that trauma.
And I guess also that one of the things that I think is very important in digesting trauma is emotional kind of comfort and support, like to be able to talk about something which was difficult and that be met in a loving, kind of kind, gentle way. There's a kind of healing, kind of soothing kind of impact of that. And I suppose I'm kind of imagining that in these indigenous cultures that there's a kind of sense that there's a lot more community, there's a lot more talking about things and kind of shared experience, which has its own healing impact, as opposed to in a kind of doing, kind of yang, kind of pushing kind of way. It's like something difficult happens, we feel some impact, but we feel kind of unloved. So we think the solution is to go and get a promotion at work, or go and drive ourselves to achieve, or go and lose weight so we become more lovable. So we think something we have to do to get the love, which is what's needed to resolve, but then we're just getting further away from it.
Absolutely. That's the perverted masculine yang energy that's there to save us, because we're unable to cope with, deal with, and process the hurt, the emotion that's caused by whatever event it is, right? So if we're sexually abused at 4 years old, I mean, for crying out loud, four-year-old's not going to know how to deal with that. Four-year-old does not have the tools to emotionally process that. Because what we're talking about is a system. We're talking about an energetic system, an emotional system. So it can't. It doesn't have the tools to cope with that, to deal with that, and to process it in a healthy way. So it develops a personality, develops a pattern. And that pattern becomes a great gift. But it is there. It is there to circumvent, to avoid the thing that they were unable to process. So the thing that they were unable to process never goes away. It's still in the mind space. It's still in the subconscious. It's still in the system. And it just has not been digested, has not been processed. So this is what we need, is we need people. We need an environment that are able to assist us, because we never learned how to process that emotion. We never learned. Now, if you had a healthy childhood, which, I mean, find somebody that does. I haven't met them yet. I think this is part of the process of spiritual development and consciousness evolving, if you will, awareness growing, is going through these things. But if you were to hypothetically have somebody that had a perfectly healthy childhood and that developed all these amazing systems that were able to deal with all this stuff, then yeah, when something happens at 22, they're like, oh yeah, I've got a system for that. I know how to deal with that. Boom, processing it, digesting it, and it's not a problem. We clear it through the system. But most of us, these things happen to us. We don't have the systems and the tools to be able to deal with them. So they get stuck. And so they're operating. And so we develop all these other tools and systems and parts and pieces to deal with anything that's going to, as we move through life. And so again, those become our great tools. So we don't lose them. That's the beautiful part. We just have to go back and find a way to process these things. And that's where environment and other people really can help us do that. And other tools too, things like meditation, you know, can over time, you know, sometimes these things may take lifetimes, to be honest, if I'm really getting serious about some of these real deep emotional traumatic wounds, sometimes it may take 40 years of meditation and work to resolve these things. Sometimes it may take two, I don't know, but we do have the self-healing tools. But again, think about meditation. I mean, we're talking about slowing down. We're talking about getting in touch with, I mean, it's all the stuff we've been talking about. So you can't resolve those traumas by doing. You just can't. You can't be the doer. Especially if it's the doer that comes on that is the part of you that saved you. Right. If it's the thing that is in response to the trauma, then you can't turn that on and resolve the trauma. You actually got to turn that thing off and learn how to process whatever emotion, whatever issue that we were unable to deal with. And so we have to have support systems, and I'm seeing that more and more. And we have more tools for that. We have things like EMDR, we have hypnotherapy, we have cranial sacral therapy, we have family constellation, we have neurofeedback. We have plant medicines that are coming about. So many tools coming online for these things, partially because there's such a huge problem in the West.
I'm mindful of time. I could talk all day about this. I'm I'm particularly, I want to find out more, people find out more, they can find out more about your work. But perhaps as part of that, just give us a bit of a kind of tease around the latest docuseries you're working on as well.
This is going to be amazing. I'm super, super excited about this docuseries. We've already been to Nepal. We've worked with, you know, it's taking a sort of Anthony Bourdain Parts Unknown style. So I'm sort of the subject going and exploring these ancient methods of healing mind, body, spirit. And so we went into the Himalayan, deep into the Himalayas at 10,000, 12,000 feet, met up with Buddhist bone healers and done amazing healing methods, exploring those things. We're going to be going to West Africa to work with the shamans of West Africa and exploring plant medicines like Iboga and other amazing healing tools that the ancient shamanic practitioners use in West Africa. We'll be in Peru in the Andes Mountains with Huachuma, which is a San Pedro type of cactus, and they do egg healing and all kinds of other healing techniques and tools. We'll be working with the Native American tribes, hopefully looking at sweat lodges and vision quests and other tools that they use for exploring these very things, these things like traumas, these things that we're dealing with in the West, these archetypal energy systems, how to find balance, how to get in touch with nature. Because these are what they work with in the indigenous cultures is they work with balance. They work with nature. They learn from nature the secrets of our biology, of the way we are. You know, when you look at things like Ayurveda, we'll be working with the Ayurvedic practitioners, yoga in India. So we're gonna be going there. It's the same thing. They're working with balance. How does nature operate? What are nature's rules? Let's play by those rules, right? So we're going to Russia to work with some of the shamans in Russia. So I'm super excited about this. It's gonna be a film series that explores these indigenous and ancient cultures. And what's cool is that if you look at a lot of the prophecies around these, in these cultures, they're actually pointing to this period of time as a time of sort of rebirth. There's all kinds of stories about the condor and the eagle, the eighth fire, the rainbow warriors, all these different myths and prophecies about this time in humanity where we are coming together, the indigenous, the feminine, the ancient ways combining with the West and breeding this new form of humanity, this golden age where all these problems that we have that we see right now become non-existent. So it's really cool to think that that might be the case, that we are in that period where this starts to merge, this starts to happen. And I'm hopeful and I'm excited that that's exactly what's happening because it's what I see. I we can all look and look at the world in our own through our own lenses, but that's what I see when I look at things.
Yeah, and what a fascinating way to go deeper rather than just kind of getting books and kind of, you know, reading research papers, to actually go there and meet the people, because I'm sure you get a different depth of insight and different nuance on that insight by actually hearing it from those people.
Absolutely. They have their own way of thinking about this, which isn't to say that's right or wrong or better or worse than the West, but what if we try to understand that perspective and their tools and their essence of how they look at these things, and we combine that with the Western model. You know, to me, this is the beautiful aspect of what we can do. And to me, that can amalgamate into a new form of understanding, particularly because I don't think you can fully use those tools in the West. In other words, you live in New York City or London, sorry, like that's a different environment than the indigenous cultures. You cannot use only their tools and operate successfully in a place like New York or London. You have to use other tools as well. And I think if we can borrow from them and also understand the way we do things and operate in a new way, I think that's how we succeed in a Western world.
That's very, very cool. That's a preview of things to come. For people that want to find out more about your work at this point in time, where's the best place to go to do that?
Yeah, they can find us at humanlongevityfilm.com. We're actually going to be relaunching our film series, actually for the last time. We're going to be making it free and available for everybody in June. So they can watch our whole series. It includes probably many people that you have in the series. Ari Witten, I'm sure, is part of this. He's a fatigue guy. Nikki Gratrix is involved. So there's lots of really amazing experts that cover a ton of topics on mitochondria and the microbiota and trauma and community and circadian rhythms and hormetic stress and all the things basically that chronic fatigue is really involved with. And so we're going to be launching that again in June. They can go to humanlongevityfilm.com to sign up for that, and we'll send them notifications of when we do that. And again, it's the last time that we're going to be showing that, and it is free. So we want to make it available for as many people as possible, because we find that it really is important for what the way the West is operating. And so that's really what we're focusing on right now. And we got more things to come, as you mentioned. So we'll focus on that in the back half of the year.
Awesome. Very cool. Jason, thank you so much. I really enjoyed this conversation. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure.